Dr. Hackner, Mandy Clemen, and we're here just to introduce ourselves, and I'm here specifically to talk to you about one of my favorite areas that I do is interventional cardiology, and specifically a technique that I've been working on for probably the last 2.5 to 3 years, and something that's now been published and now we offer to clients. So I think it's an example of the trends in veterinary specialty medicine to really push the envelope to provide new options. So I'm sort of tethered over here to play my movie, so that's why I'm standing up. But I do want this to be very, very informal and just to ask questions as we go. I'm going to be talking about some really advanced techniques and trying to explain as we go. So if something doesn't make sense, let me know. I'll slow down, try to explain it in a different way. So what we'll be talking about today, as Brenda said, is valvuloplasty, or the modification of a valve tissue. And I'm looking at two different types of valvuloplasty, including the cutting balloon. And really, it's teaching an old disease or an old dog a new trick by trying to do something new. So as some background, what subaortic stenosis is, we'll kind of go through what this congenital heart disease means and the prognosis for our patients and our pets. Look at the current treatment recommendations for this disease, and then I'll present to you what I've done and what I offer. So currently, subaortic stenosis is the first or second most common congenital heart disease in the dog, and that means that the dog was born with this disease or it was shortly developed after birth. It's actually the most common congenital heart disease, or CHD, in large breed dogs. So it's very, very important to breeders and to owners who love large breed dogs. In the U.S., it's somewhere around 25% of all congenital heart disease, and in Europe, it's probably higher. And part of that is because they see a lot of these breeds. So these pictures represent the most common breeds that we see subaortic stenosis in. And actually, all of them are my patients, except for this Rottweiler, but all four of these are some of my patients that have subaortic stenosis. So obviously, the first is German Shepherd. The next is a Newfoundland, Golden Retriever, Rottweiler, and Boxer Dog. So subaortic stenosis is basically a muscular, very tough, fibrous tissue below the aortic valve. Here you can see in this picture from the Mayo Clinic demonstrating the four chambers of the heart, the left ventricle, the right atrium, and the left atrium. This is the aorta pumping or allowing blood to go to the body. And you can see right here, there's this very tough tissue that's preventing blood from being ejected into the aorta easily. So it's basically like a thumb on the end of your garden hose, obstructing blood flow. So it's a stenosis or a narrowing, and that's what that word stenosis means. So what it does is it makes the ventricle have to pump extra hard to get the same amount of blood to the body. It's an obstruction. So by working extra hard, every heartbeat, the muscle gets thicker, just like when we lift weights, our muscles get bigger, the heart is very similar. So it's hypertrophies, it gets thicker in response to that obstruction. So this is an echocardiogram or ultrasound image of a dog with subaortic stenosis. And what this is the heart's kind of standing on its head, but this is the bottom part of the heart, this is the top part of the heart, this is the left ventricle, the pumping muscular part of the heart, the left atrium, and this is the aorta. So blood basically leaves the left ventricle and enters the aorta to go to the body. What you can see is there's a lot of white here, a lot of ultrasound tissue or ultrasound image demonstrating this protruding muscle. And all of this is normal blood flow back here, but it gets that obstruction, becomes very turbulent, and squirts into the aorta. And that makes the murmur that we hear for these dogs. So this is how we diagnose subaortic stenosis by ultrasound. So why do we care? So a thickened heart muscle causes a lot of problems. And there's numerous problems, and I've listed the most important here. But it starts out by being less flexible, less ability of stretching. It can't really receive blood very well, so the chamber is smaller. And it's a bigger, thicker heart with the same amount of blood supply. So the end result is that it runs out of oxygen and nutrients. It just doesn't get what it needs to provide that extra work. So we get little cell death, little areas around the heart that die, cause little scars, fibrosis, And these little scars set up for dead ends of electricity. So normally our heart has electricity, which starts at the top and goes to the bottom. And with SAS and little areas of cell death, hits little roadblocks, causes arrhythmias, abnormal heart rhythms. And this is where we think that the trouble begins for these guys. So when we talk about dogs with SAS, the things that the owners might see, if they have mild to moderate subaortic stenosis, they're usually asymptomatic. The only sign you may see is a murmur on physical exam. They probably are just doing fine. But the dogs that have moderate to severe subaortic stenosis, more thumb over the garden hose, more obstruction, they are typically have some type of signs. It might be very, very mild, just a funny appetite, a finicky eater, or it might be something like weakness, panting, very intolerant to heat, and it can progress from there to have exercise intolerance or fatigue with any sort of activity, fainting or syncope, or arrhythmias, very severe heart rhythms. Unfortunately, the most common outcomes that we see for dogs with severe subaortic stenosis is by far and away sudden death. They tend to die suddenly at home, usually when exercising, and this is due to those abnormal heart rhythms causing a malignant, life-ending arrhythmia. Additionally, they can have congestive heart failure or even a bacterial infection of that heart valve as it's getting beat up by the turbulent blood flow. So the prognosis for dogs with severe subaortic stenosis is very poor. And by that I mean that the statistics show that the majority of them will die suddenly by the age of three. And that's what we have to base it on. I think we see them a little bit longer than that now with our advanced care, but it's still not good. They're going to have a shortened lifespan, probably have some signs at home, and the likelihood of them dying suddenly is pretty high. Dogs with mild to moderate subaortic stenosis have a different prognosis. It's very different. Favorable to fair, they may act completely normal, and hopefully they have a near normal lifespan. They're still at risk for arrhythmias, heart failure, and infection, but they tend to do much, much better. So there's a big difference between dogs with severe versus dogs with mild to moderate.
Can I ask you a question?
Yes.
Of the whole group with SAS, is there any understanding of how many of the dogs have severe cases versus the percentage of dogs?
It's a really good question. We don't know exactly. The problem with this disease, just like so many congenital heart disease in humans too, the genetics are extremely complex. There's multiple genes and there's multiple switches. So we see a lot of dogs with variable SAS. I would say that a lot of them have severe subaortic stenosis. But I do see some with mild to moderate, but I would say the majority have severe.
And there's probably variations across breeds as well?
Definitely. No, there definitely is. I think, and this is just pulling from my experience, but I do see golden retrievers with mild SAS. The problem is that those dogs can be bred and make puppies with severe SAS. So it's a complex genetics that we deal with, but I think that the majority of dogs with SAS tend towards the severe. This is an example, just to show you, of a normal ECG, relatively normal, followed by a very malignant arrhythmia. And this is not a dog, it's a pig, but this patient is not going to survive. So currently, we have very limited treatment options for these dogs. It's a very important, common congenital heart disease, and there's just not a lot that we can do. So by far and away, the most common medical therapy, the thing that most dogs with severe SAS get, is a beta blocker, a drug to slow their heart rate down, let the heart get more filling, more nutrients per heartbeat, and not ask it to work so hard. So every dog with severe SAS is going to be on a beta blocker for the rest of its life. There's been a lot of research looking at other types of ways to help these dogs, mainly with aggressive early correction. In this case, open heart surgery has been looked at in a couple different papers, looking at using bypass and actually cutting out the lesion. This is something they've looked at in people too. The problem is that open heart surgery in dogs in general with bypass has a very high mortality rate. Currently it's about 70% for dogs with subaortic stenosis. So we don't really pursue that as an option. It's very expensive, very invasive, and the outcome is not that great. Additionally, there can be some interventional procedures, and that's what I'm going to talk to you about, balloon dilation, inserting specialized instruments into the neck or in the leg to try and create an outcome of the heart that's less invasive with less mortality risk. Unfortunately, the early studies of balloon dilation and subaortic stenosis from the early 90s weren't that great. They didn't have a really great outcome. We'll talk a little bit about that. There's a lot of adjunctive therapies, mainly looking at restricting exercise, omega-3s, and then putting them on specific medical therapy for heart failure, arrhythmias, or even prophylactic antibiotic use for various types of disease states. In the end, treatment for SAS is very frustrating. No matter what I talk about, all the things that people have looked at, it's very, very frustrating. And the bottom line is that the long-term survival for dogs with subaortic stenosis is disappointing. They're still dying at a young age. They're still dying suddenly, no matter what we do. So a lot of cardiologists, breeders, owners, everybody wants to know what else can we do for this common, frustrating, disappointing disease. So we decided to look at the balloon dilation technique that was studied in the early 90s and try and come up with a better utility of using this technique. Because it has less mortality than open heart surgery, it can also be done a little bit more cheaply for owners compared to bypass. The reason is that there's a huge advancement of balloon procedures in human medicine. There's tons of new indications for catheter-based interventional procedures with balloons in humans, both for heart disease and also for other types of diseases. Additionally, there's tons of recent novel balloons. The industry is asking for very specific balloons for specific diseases, you know, stronger, bigger, better, newer materials and whatnot. And so we wanted to try and see if we could utilize some of these new techniques. So just in general, I want to just briefly talk about what is a balloon inflation device. In general, it's a specialized inflatable balloon or tube on the end of a flexible catheter or a straw. And this straw or catheter is fed over a wire into the body. So in the case of this, we do a small incision over the neck, and it passes over a wire into the carotid, into the heart. It can also go into any vessel, to the kidneys, anywhere. So this is an example of one of the balloons we used. Yes. This is an example of one of the balloons that we used, and this is pretty typical, except that this is the special balloon that we used. This is the high-pressure balloon. So the wire would go in this end, okay, and into wherever we're putting it, and then we would track this balloon deflated over the wire into the heart. So we inflate the balloon with a mixture of saline and contrast so we can see it. And in this case, this balloon can achieve a very high pressure. So I'm going to pass it around, and you guys can feel it's soft right now, but at the end, I'll go ahead and inflate it so you can see how tough it really is. This one's made out of Kevlar, and I'll talk to you about that in a little bit. So you just kind of see what a balloon is. There's a million types of balloons, low pressure, high pressure, cutting balloons. So in general, the reason that it's important to look back at these things is that now we've got a balloon for every place in the body. So some of these balloons are used to inflate vessels, very small vessels, including coronary arteries and people with coronary artery disease and heart attacks, including arteries to the kidney that have been stenosed by inflammation. Just you name it, we have a balloon to blow up a stenosis or a narrowing. So this is where we come into what I'm here to talk to you about, combining a very special balloon called the cutting balloon and the high-pressure balloon made of Kevlar for dogs with severe subaortic stenosis. And our goal and what we are doing is to provide a new option for an old disease. So first, let's talk about cutting balloons. So cutting balloons are balloons that have blades on them. They've been shown to be safe and successful in humans since the early 90s for both coronary artery disease as well as pulmonary artery stenosis in babies. So they've been extensively researched. And what they are is a tiny little balloon that has blades on them, and they are called artherotomes. They're not your standard surgical blade. They're much, much sharper. Based on how they make them. And here's an example of a cutting balloon. They're very small. The largest one they make is 8 millimeter, okay? And they go all the way down to 2 millimeters. But this is a cutting balloon. It's been inflated, and you can see this longitudinal blade, and there's usually 3 or 4 around it radially. So this is an example of a cutting balloon that we've used. It's deflated here on the left, And the blades are protected inside the deflated balloon. So when you insert this into any vessel or the heart, it's protected. The tissue is protected from the balloon, from the blades. Once you inflate it, though, these blades expand radially, and now we can engage a tissue. So that's the basis of the cutting balloon. So what it's, yep.
The blades actually latch on?
No, they just, I have a nice video to show you, but they basically just, instead of being curled up in a deflated balloon, when you inflate the balloon, they'll come out like little wings. And now the sharp edge is out. So they'll engage. Exactly. Connecting. Yeah, it's hopefully cutting. It's supposed to make precise cuts in the tissue. So you have to measure the stenosis appropriately so that you only cut what you want. So it's going to, yeah, it's going to deliver longitudinal scores wherever you inflate, okay? But once you deflate and take it out, it's no longer going to be cutting, okay? And what you do is then you take out the cutting balloon and insert another balloon and open up the scores that you just made, open up those cuts. It's a way to balloon resistant lesions. So they've shown numerous studies in babies and adults that the cutting balloons are to be used when you have lesions that are resistant to typical balloon dilation, really tough lesions. And they also prevent restenosis and have a better outcome for those really tough lesions. Most commonly, it's being used right now for coronary artery disease in people before they put a stent in for heart attack patients. So this is a video, and what you see is this is a vessel. You'll see a wire come in, and then the cutting balloon will be tracked over it, and it's going to basically score and balloon dilate this lesion right here. Maybe. Well, hold on. Said. It's telling me.
Did you copy it from something else? Or did you...
Well, what we can do is I can play it here. Hopefully the other videos work later.
This always happens.
Yes. Mm-hmm. I was very pretty proud that the first video worked. All right, so this is, I spliced it, but here's the same video. Basically, they're going to show the vessel. The wire enters. Here comes the deflated cutting balloon. Cutting balloon is inflated. The blades are expanded radially, and now it's engaging with the tissue and cutting. So we're not actually using force to spread the lesion. We're actually cutting the lesion. And that's the kind of the ingenuity of the cutting balloon, is we're using less force to achieve a better dilation. Now the cutting balloon is removed, leaving behind these scores. Now we're going to follow it up with a standard ballooning and actually open up those scores. Again, use force this time, but probably get a much, much better dilation because we've already started the process.
These would be great for esophageal structures.
Yeah,
Well, you don't really need a blade for esophageal structures. They usually do pretty well with balloons. We usually just do pressure balloons. The problem with them is that they scar down again. You know, so you can dilate them really well. Problem is that they just keep scarring down, but now we go in and inject some steroid into them so that when we expand them, they don't scar down quite as well. I've had to do that a few times.
The problem with the cutting balloon is they don't make them very big.
Actually, right, I was thinking 8 millimeters.
8 millimeters, so it works out well for my patients with SAS because their lesions are really tight. Right. But I've had a company work for the last 2 years to make bigger ones for me, and they say that when you get any bigger, to a certain point, the device doesn't work. The blades fail. Oh, so nice. We're going to stick with what they know and stick with the 8 millimeter. But
I'd be scared.
It's a really remarkable balloon. It does amazing things. So the next balloon. So we're going to use the cutting balloon in the really tight, tough stenosis in these dogs, and we're following up with a high pressure balloon, and that's what you got to touch. This is called the Atlas. And it's made for the aortic valve in people prior to an aortic valve replacement. So it's made for this anatomy. And so it's been dubbed kind of the Superman balloon by Cornell, and I like it because it really is, there's nothing else like it on the market. It's made from Kevlar, it's extremely tough, and it achieves a pressure, a higher atmosphere than anything else. And I mean, it not even close, about 10 times every other balloon. So it can achieve very high pressures, like I said, much higher than other balloons. It does require an inflation device here to achieve. We're going above 10 atmospheres. 10 to 12 atmospheres is the pressure it should achieve, but it can go up to 18. So you can't get that with your hand. So that's the other difference, is we've been using an inflation device that we dial up the pressure that we want, okay? So that's this, and when we're all done, I'll blow it up so you guys can see. It feels like concrete when you get up, when you can blow it up. So I won't be able to get up to 10 atmospheres in my hand, but we'll see how high we can go. So I'm gonna just go through the procedure in a nutshell for you. The first thing we do is we need to do some imaging studies to see the heart and make measurements so I can pick out the right balloon. So the two imaging techniques we use are called angiography and fluoroscopy. It's for us to see the heart. Fluoroscopy is like real-time x-ray. If you've seen in the movies when people walk through the airport and you can see their bones moving, that's fluoroscopy. So the first thing we do is make a small incision in the neck to dissect down to the carotid artery. And from there, I can have all the access I need to the heart. So we place a pigtail catheter into the carotid artery. It's called a pigtail because it has this little pigtail-like curl to the end. It's very soft and atraumatic, so I can put that across the aortic valve and not do any damage to the heart and get a way to get some images. So that's placed over a wire into the carotid, into the heart, and we inject dye while we watch the heart on these two techniques so that I can see the heart in real time. So this is an example, a still image just to show you, and then we'll look at the movies. Hopefully they work. But this is a normal dog, and we might want to... We'll try it without the lights off, but this is basically the heart. We've got his sternum down here. His head is up here, his diaphragm, liver, and tail back here. So we have a pigtail coming down his neck, down his carotid, and into the left ventricle. So maybe we should turn the lights down, right? Kind of bright. Okay. Oh, much better.
Yeah, that's
good. So I'm injecting dye into a normal dog. This is a normal dog. And at this point, the dye is seen inside the left ventricular chamber. He's contracting, so the chamber's small. And there's a nice column of contrast, what we call entering the aorta with no obstruction, and it's going down this way. This dog is very, very different. This is a dog with subaortic stenosis. Again, the pigtail's down his carotid artery into his aorta, down into his left ventricle, and we've got contrast being injected here and being pushed out by the heart into the aorta. This is a very obstructive lesion. You know, he's only got about 30% of what it should be. It should be this whole area should be open. So based on these techniques, I can then measure the length of the stenosis and measure the length of his aortic annulus, or the diameter, calculate the diameter of his aorta. So let's hope these work. So this is the same two dogs. You can just see them now in real time. Oh, good. Oh, it flipped it. That's weird. So this is a normal dog pumping the contrast out. I just put it in the heart, and he pushes it forward. And you can see there's no obstruction to flow. It's nice and open. Versus this dog has subaortic stenosis. And there's really a tight squeeze there. He's got to push all the blood to the body past that little stenosis. And that's why they don't do well long term. So here's some pictures.
Were both of those the same speed? Because the one on the right, was it pushing faster because it was trying to push harder to get through the...
This one looks a little bit slower to me.
But it seems like the contraction of the muscle seems more acute.
Some speed
I think that what it is that this is a healthy heart. This is a more normal contraction.
Yeah,
when the heart contracts, it's actually like you're wringing a washcloth.
Right, that's what
it contracts
like
this. So this muscle is very thick. I mean, you can see how thick this muscle is, and it's just not contracting well.
Yeah, exactly.
It's like a delay and then it pushes out.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. It looks so different.
Yeah, part of the pathology is the muscle is really doing its best and so thick it's really not able.
How old was it, like the dog on the right? How long did it have?
This dog, all the dogs that I put in my study were less than 2 years old.
Okay.
So I don't know off the hand, but this dog was probably about between 1 and 1.5,
right,
the vast majority. So he'd been living with this for a year to a year and a half. It is, and every time it's the same. Extra work every single time.
As long times in the day.
So this is a couple of just still images to go through the rest of the procedure, and then I'm going to show you some movies. But in this case, this is the size of the cutting balloon, so you can appreciate how small it is. But if you go back and we'll look again, that stenosis is really tight. So my goal is to cut that stenosis. I don't want to cut the aorta. I don't want to cut the rest of the heart. I just want to go there. So this is an ideal size for most of these dogs based on how tight their stenosis is. So this is the cutting balloon. A wire has been put down into the carotid, down into the heart. Here's this little wire. And the cutting balloon's then tracked into the heart. And once we're in the proper place, based on fluoroscopy and looking at the angiograms, we inflate it. And the dog's heart's going to push it into the lesion and cut. And if it's inflated and in the lesion, it is cutting. And I can tell you, I'm the one holding onto the balloon. I can feel it being tight in the lesion, and it's cutting.
And what diameter did you say that balloon is?
This is 8 millimeter. Okay. It's 8 millimeter by 2 centimeters. So it's 2 centimeters long and 8 millimeters wide. And, okay. And on echo, these dogs, the tight lesion, it varies from about 3 to 8.
Okay.
So some of these dogs are really getting a really good score. But every dog, it's engaged. It's stuck in the lesion. So this is a transesophageal echo image. Another way that we can see that the balloon is where we want it. So in this case, now the heart's kind of horizontal. Here's the aorta. This is the aortic valve itself. It kind of looks like that little butt there. And then this is the balloon inflated. And you see this longitudinal bright line? That's the blade. There's another blade. So I can tell that this balloon is where I want it, both here, based on looking at the previous angiogram, and here, that it's where I want it. And it's not up in here somewhere. Okay. So we cut... score the lesion with the cutting balloon, we remove everything, okay, and then we stick another wire. This time it's a very strong, big wire to try and hold this big balloon back into the heart, and we then send a deflated, this is a smaller one too, to be honest, down into the heart, and we inflate it. The first thing we see as we inflate this is at low pressures, we see the lesion. There's a waste, we call that a waste. And then once we get up to 10 atmospheres, it usually pops open, some of them stretch open, and we see that the waste has been reduced. And we've really done a good job opening up the lesion. And every dog we've done this in, we've seen this progression. At high, we need the high pressures to really pop it open. So here's a video of a dog with the cutting balloon inflated in its subaortic stenosis. So we're slowly inflating the balloon. There's a little air bubble there. And now the as I'm pulling it and pushing it a little bit, helping it out, the heart is also contracting. And you notice the balloon doesn't pop forward all the way into the aorta. Because it's stuck in the stenosis. And then, you know, we move it a little bit to ensure that we're really doing a good job scoring it. And these blades are very tight. I didn't bring one because it is a little bit of a hazard. One of our other cardiologists ran his fingers along and he cut his fingers immediately. So they're very, very sharp. Dr. Prosek did that. All right, so here's a couple, two different dogs with the high pressure Superman balloon after the cutting balloon, and you'll see that the waste is present, and then you'll see the waste reduced. And then it takes us to get up to high pressures to do it. So there's the waste. Hold on, it's going to open some more. It opens at high pressures. This dog, now this is more, in my mind, the cutting balloon is scary, but not as scary as this. I'm obstructing all blood flow to his body right now. So we want to be very quick, very efficient, know I'm where I am, know the balloon is the correct size, and that I have somebody very good, hopefully a criticalist, doing anesthesia for me to monitor the dog so I can concentrate on the balloon. Here's another dog. There it is. And wait till it pops, and then usually get another one. Yep, opens up some more. So we think the reason that the older studies in the early 90s didn't have as good of success, they didn't have anywhere near the pressure we were using. This is a muscular lesion. On histopathology, it's muscle, it's fibrous tissue. So you really need to have some strong balloon to try and modify the lesion. One thing I wanted to show is that these two dogs, pictures of the actual dogs that were in the procedure, and it's being difficult for me. You'll see their pictures again. But this one is from a boxer named Murphy, and this one's from a golden retriever named Lakota. So you'll see their picture again. So these are real patients that have had this procedure.
How long ago was that?
Yeah, so all of these, I've done all of these in the last 2 years. So Lakota was a more recent one. That was the last one I've done. And Murphy was probably about a year ago. So, but these are the 14 patients that have had this procedure done. And importantly, to show you that this is not something experimental anymore, something we've really done in clinical patients that are really sick. And all of them did very well during the procedure. Our first goal was to first find out if it was safe, so we did no harm. The second was to find out if it's physically possible, if it's feasible. And we found out that it was feasible. These balloons could be used within the heart and to force subaortic stenosis. The cutting balloon in humans is only used for vascular lesions. So this was our first goal, safe and feasible. The next goal is to find out, have we helped them? So of these 14 patients, have we helped them? And we don't have all the answers yet. I'm still following up on them. It's only been 2 years since the first one had it done. But I have presented these results at the American College of Veterinary Internal Medicine as an oral abstract in June that was in Anaheim, as well as the Pediatric Interventional Cardiac Catheterization Symposium in Chicago. And because human, right, because it was very exciting. Our short-term findings for the acute and midterm data up to 6 months in all the dogs statistically shows that we have a significant decrease in their severity, moderately decrease in their severity, and that goes across the board. But maybe more importantly, we've seen subjective and objective findings that show that we're doing a good deed and a good service to these sick patients. The first thing, the subjective finding, is almost all the owners have reported a dramatic increase in energy. Most of these dogs were the poor doers of the litter, the ones that really didn't want to play, that had a really poor appetite, didn't grow, just didn't do as well as their litter mates. I would say 12 out of the 14 now have a major personality difference. They're extremely rambunctious, getting into trouble, young, large breed dogs acting like very energetic and enthusiastic. A lot of the owners report that they didn't actually know their dog until after the procedure. Objective findings, again, across the board, almost all of them had an improvement in their clinical signs. They're gaining weight, and they're eating better, and we've had less fainting and less heat intolerance, and they're obviously able to exercise better. So we have the patients are doing well, but statistically, importantly, that the numbers are telling us that we're doing a good job as well. Additionally, sort of, this is something ongoing to look at the numbers, but it looks like the results show that this type of balloon valvuloplasty may be most beneficial for those dogs with the really severe stenoses, that we may be doing the best for them. So, you know, I think this is a good example of where we're going in veterinary medicine, in veterinary specialty medicine. We're taking some innovations and insight from humans and trying to apply it to our dogs, really trying to push, like as I said, push the envelope and come up with new ideas. So this is a picture, you said, of when this was done. This is Lady. She was the very, very first, very brave girl to be the first. And this is the picture I took with her in December, just this past December. She's 2 years post-balloon valvuloplasty, and she's one of the ones that the owners really feel like they didn't even know her before. She was a lump, and now she's a kind of a bad golden retriever. She gets in trouble. So I think this is a good example of where we're going, what we can do.
How old was she when you did it?
She was about a year and 2 months. So now she's 3 years and 2 months, basically. Doing great.
Do you think, will this progress into other animals?
Meaning other types of stenotic lesions?
Can you see doing this on cats?
So luckily, cats don't get subaortic stenosis very commonly. I've only seen one, so lucky for them. There are other, we do balloon valvuloplasty routinely for the right heart, pulmonic stenosis. That is, fortunately, a very wimpy lesion, so I don't need to use these advanced balloons. But I use balloon valvuloplasty to balloon a stenotic lesion in the right heart all the time, and we have great success. We basically cure those dogs. So I think for resistant lesions, yes, I've had a colleague who then used the cutting balloon for urethral stricture, a really bad one that was so tight they couldn't get a standard balloon in. So the cutting balloon is where we're going for resistant lesions that don't respond to balloon dilation throughout the body. Yeah?
Can you describe something about the resilience of these internal valves where it just seems incredible that 2 seconds of pressure and it wouldn't go back to what it once was.
So you're,
plus you don't want to stretch it like forever, right?
Right. No, your points, 2 points that you make are very, very important. I don't want to overstretch it. So that's why we do those imaging techniques. I'm measuring the length, the width of the aorta at the valve, because I don't want to oversize it. In humans, they've shown when they balloon this area, if they oversize it, they get a lot of leakage. They damage the valve, they get a lot of leakage. So we don't want to oversize it. So all these dogs, I picked this balloon that matched that hinge point, the width. So that's important. The next thing is restenosis, or return of the lesion, is possible. It's been reported in humans all the time. We're dealing with a tissue that could scar down. The good thing is that's what the cutting balloon has shown, that by cutting the lesion before we use basically brute force to open it, we get less scarring, less inflammation. They've shown the cutting balloon reduces restenosis in pulmonary arteries, coronary arteries, and kidney renal arteries, because we're doing cutting and then kind of the brute force. So I'm following these dogs for restenosis. I haven't really seen restenosis, but it's something I'm concerned about. So we'll see.
Would you know by the sound of the heart, or would you actually have to look at the heart?
That's a good question. I don't know by the sound. Even the dogs with pulmonic stenosis that we really do a good job to make them be normal dogs forever, they still have a murmur, because they still have some turbulence, but it's the force of the turbulence that is the severity. So a mild dog, a mild SAS or a mild pulmonic stenosis will still have a murmur. It might not radiate as widely through the chest. It might not be as forceful of a murmur or as harsh, but we need to look and measure the velocity of blood flow, to be honest, to know how severe it is.
Does the heart muscle adjust itself to be more normal, less thick?
That's also a good question. On echo, measurement of thickness is very hard. I'm measuring the thickness, but also trying to calculate the mass and looking at that over time. I haven't seen a dramatic change in that yet, but I think part of it is that my goal was to start doing this in younger animals to catch it before the fibrosis and before the scarring, and that's why I didn't want to do it in anybody older than two, but even earlier would be nicer. I think that pathophysiologically, we understand a lot about on the biochemical cellular level what happens when hearts get thick. I think we must be changing that you know, protein buildup and all of the energies that we're using. But grossly, it's hard to say on echo. Even in humans, really hard to measure that.
We do have some other models of animals with where their hearts become really hypertrophied, and then we fix the underlying condition,
yes.
And it, like hyperthyroid cats,
mm-hmm.
where the heart actually does correct itself.
Yep.
So we know it's feasible.
It might take, I think it's going to take time. So Lady's special, she's 2 years out, but the rest of them are only about a year out. So I'll see.
What are you telling clients about risk of complications?
Great question.
Prognosis?
So all dogs have arrhythmias during the procedure. They have a sick heart, and I am introducing wires and big objects into a twitchy heart. So they all have arrhythmias. So the possibility of having malignant arrhythmias requiring treatment is very high. They all need lidocaine. Complications of arrhythmias is going to happen. I also worry about damage to the heart. You know, we talk about how scary it is. I am introducing blades. I am introducing a very high pressure device into the heart. So I always talk to them about leakage across the aortic valve as being a minimal complication, or, you know, perforating the heart or killing them. So that's a possibility. So far it hasn't happened. And I haven't seen any...
This is laminate.
I haven't seen any bad leakage either. So, but especially for Lady, you know, that's something that I'm very upfront with them. I tell them everything I know, and we just make the best decision for the dog. So for Lady's family, they said it's worth it. You know, we have kids. We wanted to really try our best to give her the quality of life she needs. Plus, they're usually a little sick, so that helps us make decisions. I think that it's important to tell them that the dog will let me know how long they need to recover. I've had probably about 30% need an extra night. The majority of these dogs go home the next day, but some of them need an extra night for arrhythmias. Some of them I need to change from atenolol to sotalol, different antiarrhythmic, short term. So I am going to insult the heart in the short term. Hopefully it's, you know, in my experience, it's been a not that big of an insult, and it's really worth it. But so death is a possibility.
Does it make any difference, the complication as well as the, just the how you experience it as a doctor,
the size of the dog? In other words, is it easier to do this on a larger dog than a smaller dog?
That's also a great question. One of the dogs I did was a Burmese Mountain Dog. She's massive, and it was harder. Partly because I think the cutting balloon may not engage as well. It's a bigger dog. You know, she had an 8mm stenosis, and I'm using an 8mm balloon. But also, I have now used a bigger one of those. And when you get to a dog, I'd say, again, about 30%, a balloon that's bigger than this, you actually need a third person to scrub in to inject more fluid quickly. So we use a three-way stopcock, and we basically, so it's technically more challenging in a bigger dog for a couple of reasons. So another reason why I think I need to be getting them younger before they are 120 pounds and before the heart has some changes. So I prefer them small.
But if they're confused.
So I've gone to some facilities to try and teach this technique to other cardiologists, including Cornell. So we have done one successfully at Cornell, a German Shepherd. But they have two others, and so we're going to try and find time for me to go there and do some more with them. And one of them is too small. She is a really poor doer German Shepherd. She's just not growing. So we've been waiting for her to grow to get to the smallest Atlas. It's just not going to happen. So we're going to use the cutting balloon, and we're going to use a different high-pressure balloon that's just not quite as fantastic, but hopefully still get a good result. So not too small.
What is your cutoff as far as size?
So it depends on the aorta. That's the thing. So she's, I don't know her exact size. My guess is she's probably about 65 pounds. But it also depends on the dog, because some of them can be, you know, the males are not going to be neutered, because they probably, these dogs should not have anesthesia for elective procedures. So the unneutered males are very heavy. They're muscular, they weigh a lot, but their aorta is about the same size as their female sister mate who has SAS and is very thin. So it depends on the dog, but we look at the aorta to tell me whether I should be doing this procedure or not.
And it's not a disease of small breeds. You know, we don't see it in the Maltese and the Yorkshire Terrier.
Yeah.
Unfortunately,
because that would be I've seen it in a couple small breeds, and it's very common. So,
Do you have a call for patients, or you're teaching some cardiologists? How are you getting it out?
So part of it is speaking. So ACVIM helped a lot. I was mentioning to you guys that I think this is a very hot topic right now because SAS is such a horrible, devastating disease. So part of it's just telling people. I've had Texas contact me, UC Davis contact me, and now Cornell, obviously. So word of mouth, but also conferences. Right now, I'm not. This study was funded by AKC as well as ACVIM and some small amount from UF. So I'm not taking more patients in anymore, but now I'm offering it as a service. So the last three times I've done it has been for clients who paid for the procedure.
It's a good idea to put out a call to the area.
Yep.
Which brings up the topic
of It is.
It's a good idea to put out the call in the area.
Cost, it's not cheap. The balloons themselves are expensive. So the cutting balloon, I think they just raised the price, but it's between $500 and $600 just for the balloon. The Atlas balloon is between $350 and $450. I think the biggest one is $500. So we're talking about $1,000 roughly just for balloons themselves cost. So it's also regionally dependent as far as how much anesthesia costs and whatnot. I would say it's going to be between $4,000 and $6,000 for the procedure, which is not bad, to be honest. Pulmonic stenosis balloon valvuloplasty is going to be almost the same price. So I think that we're doing a good job. Obviously, in a person, who knows, this would be...
That's actually less than I expected you to say. My last Newfoundland cost $2,500 as a pilot.
Well, so a Newfie might cost more. Now we're thinking, like, because Newfies, they cost more for everything. They're so big. And it depends on the dog. You know, this is without complication. So the 30% of dogs that need an extra hospitalization, that's going to be extra and things like that. So if they have problems. But for hopefully... For the ones that go well, they come in, they do the procedure the next day, they go home the next day. They only spend 2.5 days in hospital. So the hospitalization stay is short, and that's why the cost is not as much as, say, a orthopedic procedure on a Newfie that needs rehabilitation and whatnot.
In terms of the you teaching doctors to do this, how, you know, is it a skill that, like, almost any vet could pick up, or you need somebody who's really
popular? Yeah, so you need a cardiologist. I think you bring up a good point that it's a team of people that come to the table for this type of procedure, even when it's just a standard balloon dilation. Right. So, at, for example, at Cornell, at CVS, at UF, I'll have a criticalist, an anesthesiologist in the room for the dog. And then I'm concentrating.
That nice strip all
that no. And it,
not unlikely, impossible.
Impossible, yeah. And yeah. And just to know how to handle the wires and the balloons,
right. Even just
it takes a interventionally heavy 3 years of a cardiology residency. So there are some cardiologists that haven't had training in interventional cardiology, and then there are some that have. And so the ones that have then just need to learn about how to handle a cutting balloon.
Right. So people who are in this field, it's a natural extension of what they do.
It is. It is.
If you aren't in the field, it's...
Right. Yeah. And then I also think, you know, we do not anesthetize dogs with SAS. So just the fact that we're anesthetizing this disease is a new concept. You know, the old adage is don't ever anesthetize or sedate a dog with SAS because they could have arrhythmias, they could die. So we've done two things, I think. We've sort of decided, well, let's push the envelope with doing anesthesia. And you really need a team of people to do that.
Yeah. Is the Cornell Veterinary Medicine office in Stanford the only one in the metropolitan area that is doing this?
Cornell University Veterinary Specialist?
Yes.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
And does that mean that referring doctors in the tri-state area know?
I did have one of the patients that I've talked to probably five owners in the last 2 weeks about this procedure coming to CVS and doing it, and two of them came from cardiologists, so they know. Again, I've helped, not in person, but extensively. One case has been ballooned at UC Davis, and it was successful, but it took a lot of discussion for them to feel good about it, and then I've helped with the one at Cornell, so. I think I'll be popping around and getting people to try it because, again, it's the disease state is why we're doing this. It's just a horrible disease, so.
You have to have the C-arm.
You have to have fluoroscopy and angiogram capability.
That's several hundred thousand dollars.
Yeah.
It's not like a garage.
And I hate to say that it's about the equipment. It's a lot of people years of training.
I have a picture of the actual unit that we use for this, so I can pull that up just to show you. Okay, I lied. It's on my other part of my laptop, but I can show you. But one thing I would definitely want to do is to blow up the balloon so you can appreciate how strong it is. So, and hopefully, I brought the wrong lure lock, but hopefully I don't squirt you in the face. But this is just saline, promise. So this was used in a dog, probably a boxer because it's not very big. You just want to hold it, and then you feel as I inflate it. Hold on, let me get the air out of there.
Mandy, maybe you can talk about some of the other stuff you're doing in the cath lab.
Yes. It's getting there. So I need the inflation device, I think. That's getting there.
Yeah.
You're sick. You're sickly. Getting there, huh? Not so much. But you can appreciate that it's... It gets as hard as a rock when I have the right inflation device, but I can try.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, I think I do better with my hand than my waist.
That's crazy. That's great.
So if you think about, we're at one atmosphere, and this goes up to 10 to 12. So, I mean, it's 10 times what we're in this room. Ready?
Wow.
One more time.
Yep. Only I can't shake, though. Ready?
And this stays in for about 3 seconds?
As long as it takes to inflate and deflate, it's about that long.
Up
yeah.
and down.
This,
and
the one thing about this is it's so big that it does take a while to inflate, and then you have to deflate before you can take it out. So that is...
That sounds very hard.
Well, hold on. Oop, did I break it?
No, you're getting saline on you.
Ready?
Well, it's getting somewhere now. I can squeeze that.
So it just takes a lot of force, and I think I'm wearing out as I go.
I used to race bicycles, and we use carbon Kevlar things, and we're up to 150 psi for the bicycle tires. And
translate psi now.
Well, that's 8-9 bar. So
okay. Oh yeah, that's high. Yeah. So that's basically where we're going with that. So I do have a couple other things I can show you.
Rolling resistance, and then you have these tires. It's awesome. Because you want the
Let me show you this, just because I have more show and tell. So one more thing. So we've done a couple other really cool things in the last week or so at CVS. So I thought I'd bring more show and tell. I brought a pacemaker for you guys to see, because I did get to put a pacemaker in a bulldog last week. So this is the dog. His name is Sherman. Maybe we should turn the lights on again. So this is Sherman. He's an 8-year-old English bulldog, and he went to his local vet because he was having a hard time going up the stairs. He normally would run up the stairs, and he would stop halfway, and his heart rate was very low. So he had complete heart block. It's also common in people where the electricity going from the top of the heart to the bottom was just obstructed, usually by a little scar. So he came in for evaluation for pacemaker implantation. So we do put pacemakers in animals fairly commonly, or actually not uncommonly. I used to put one in about one a month or so. So I'm hoping to let people know that we do this as well. So this is all pictures of pacemakers that I've put in, except for this one over here. I borrowed that from a colleague. But this is a dog, cat. So we typically put pacemakers in, again, through the neck. So we don't have to crack the chest, do invasive surgery. And I can advance a lead from the jugular vein into the right heart and basically cause an electrical impulse. So this is a lead in the right atrium of a dog who has a different type of a block. And then this is two leads, one in the right atrium, one in the right ventricle, again in the right atrium. This is a cat. They're too small to pass leads down the jugular vein, so we actually go through the belly. So again, we don't have to crack their chest open, do invasive thoracic surgery. We can just go through the diaphragm. You can see how big that the generator or computer part looks in a cat's belly. But they're all about this size. And I brought one for you guys to see. There's a couple different lead types. This is my favorite. It has little feathers, plastic feathers, that engage the heart passively, and then over the next 3 to 6 weeks, it fibroses into place. I have used these. I have used these as well. These are active fixation. You screw it into the heart. They work great, but they're made for people, so we don't exactly know how many screws to go before you're through the heart, so you just got to be very careful. So this is a picture of us with Sherman. I was putting the pacemaker in here in our fluoro CT or CRM room. And then we do have to evaluate the pacemaker, and I can talk to the generator, talk to the little computer with my computer equipment. Put basically a wand over his neck and tell it what heart rate I want it to be, how fast to pace, and all the different parameters. And then this is him when he went home with his family. So it was, they're great immediate gratification cases. So we like them. Good question. So this is a pacemaker generator. It's pretty standard. They're about silver dollar in size. They've advanced tremendously in the last 20 years. They're, extremely smart. So this is the battery. So this goes in his neck right here, and hopefully they never need to be changed. So the one I put in Sherman had 6.5 years of battery life, and he's 8 years old. So hopefully okay. But if so, this part that's in the heart is already done. The hard part's done. Then I just have to change out little surgery on his neck, which I've done before. The generators we get have not usually been implanted in a person. I've never put in one that came out of a person. They're all new. They've just been sitting on the shelf, and now the battery life's not long enough for a person. So that's where this one came from. So this one will be probably re-sterilized, and I'll put it in an animal so you guys can pass around. But these computers are so advanced, they actually can, I can set the rate so that if it senses movement, has a little piezoelectric crystal, if it senses movement, it'll increase the heart rate.
So the device itself never changes in size. It would only be the catheter that...
They get a little bit bigger. The devices that have two leads are a little bigger. So this one, just a little bit bigger than, say, this one. But they're not much bigger than this. Like 1.5 times this would be the biggest. They just look bigger in a smaller animal. So I'll pass that around. And you can see the little plastic tines on the end. So that's a great case. I talked to the owners. Yes. Yeah, we see, basically, we have two populations of dogs that needs pacemakers. Big, usually older, fat labs that are getting overweight because they don't have a heart rate to support exercise. Or we have the small Schnauzers, Westies, Dachshunds, Maltese.
Maltese?
I put a pacemaker in a Maltese.
Do they have a tendency towards heart problems?
They're on our list, but lower down. Mm-hmm. They have two reasons to need pacemakers, but not nearly as commonly as a Schnauzer or a Dachshund, for example. So that was one case. The other one I wanted to highlight was heart surgery. So, of course, these are all cardiocentric cases, but this is Zolti. She was is an 8-year-old golden retriever that came into our emergency service with pericardial effusion or fluid around her heart sac. And she had, unfortunately, a large mass on her right atrium. So this large mass on her heart was causing the fluid around her heart sac. It's a malignant, bad cancer on her right atrium. But because we have Dr. Kramer, our surgeon, he actually was able to do surgery with the help of our criticalist for anesthesia, again, to remove not only the mass, but part of the heart around the mass to try and get good margins. And the surgery went extremely well. It's not a common surgery. It's you guys know it's a difficult surgery, and it went extremely well. The dog just did really great. And this is a picture of our surgery suite with Dr. Kramer doing surgery, basically heart surgery. So he did open up the chest, isolated the lesion, and took out a very large bleeding mass from the heart. So it was really, really great. And then Zolti recovered, spent about 4 days in our emergency our intensive critical care unit, and is now at home doing great. So, very happy. So that's Zolti.